This is a Collider.com audio interview.
So I want to ask you this. Whose idea was to have Broken Social Scene doing a Joy Division song at a wedding? I figured that would be the deal breaker. They would not get paid for doing that song at a wedding. I don't know.
That was my choice.
Oh, okay.
I actually collect versions of that song.
Oh, nice.
I have done that for a long time. And I like Broken Social a lot, and I met them in L.A. And I very early on had thought, you know, we should use that kind of a song, because in the novel there's a lot of music, and most of the music mentioned in the novel is the kind of music I tend to listen to. So I connected to that, and I felt if Ma and Pa pay for this affair, and if we, you know, cast extras as guests who don't look like Henry's and Claire's friends, then at least they get to pick the song. So,
what do you say to people who see a lot of movies, and even critics do this sometimes too, that they say, well, it's not as good as the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the book. I mean, it's something different. What is your response to that?
That's a very complicated, big thing. Well, first of all, obviously, you know, I resort to, there are two different mediums. The novel, there are very few films that work like a novel. We're more like a short story, you know, sort of symphony versus sonata. We kind of, our narratives move toward a cataclysmic event at the end. And keeping that in mind means that when you extract, you know, a strand, that's what you kind of have to stick to. So we committed to the love story for obvious reasons. It's the backbone of the book. It's what I fell in love with. It's what we all fell in love with. No pun intended. And the backbone of the book also became the backbone of the film. And whatever felt off the spine kind of didn't make the cut. You know, whatever went beyond the love story, because if you start with it and you end with it, and you're already spinning lots of plates, you're already looking at a lifetime these people spend together. It's not like there's not plenty there already. You just realize, you know, the film kind of starts to have its own pulse. It's not like you get up in the morning, first day of shooting, and you say, okay, I'm so smart today, I'm going to determine every choice I'm going to make, you know, from now until, you know, a year and a half from now. So it changes. Things shift. You gain insights. The movie bucks you. The movie, you know, doesn't want to do what you want it to do. And so it just grows, and then you have, you know, you have a movie at the end of it, hopefully.
Can you talk about the color red that was used throughout this mm-hmm. film, and do you think that audience members are going to pick up on that?
You know, it depends on what you look for, I suppose. The first time around, I hope there are other things that they're looking at mm-hmm. rather than sort of color schemes. But I do believe that there's an accumulative effect to all of those things, and that you know, that it's a way to sort of provide the audience with a bit of a manual. Mm-hmm. You know, we color coded characters, we color coded certain situations, and there's one thought, you know, it's kind of an obscure thought, but since you're asking, the color red, of course, is sort of connected with, the connotation is death. It comes out first during Christmas, and of course she has, the little girl has in the meadow a red blanket, and to me, yes, he did travel to the meadow because of her, because she was going to be the most important person in his life, but also because it was going to be the locus of his death. So to me, do I get to say that here? No. Anyway, so the color red there has definitely that same meaning. So it's not a lapse in our judgment. It was kind of a conscious choice to do that. And it's obscure. I you know, but what do you do?
Thank you.
Can you talk about casting? Rachel mm-hmm. was attached to this even
yes.
before you came along.
Yes, yes, and I thought that was a great choice, because she has that kind of vulnerability that you need. I mean, here's an 8-year-old girl in a meadow playing by herself, and a guy shows up and says, "I'm going to be your friend for the rest of your life," or a version thereof. You have to be open and available to that kind of insanity, and I think she's, you know, she made that very believable. And then I met Eric for a general, and I was really taken with, you know, how, you know, how grounded and accessible he was, and he's a very dedicated family man. He's a dedicated husband, and he's a good, decent, really truly decent man. And those are qualities that I felt were important for the character, because also given his masculine persona from past films, I felt that he would never play Henry as a victim, which was very, very, very important to me. I didn't, even though, you know, time travel arguably is a metaphor for affliction, any kind of affliction, I didn't want him to play him as a victim.
Could you talk a little bit about what might be, you obviously cut stuff for the film, mm-hmm. What might end up on the DVD?
I commit to one version, and that's kind of it.
You don't do delete scenes?
I don't do delete scenes. Because I believe so far, I've always felt that the movies arrived at a certain form, and there were reasons why they arrived at that form, and those were, you know, insights were being gathered along the way, and I think it's okay if there's just one film out there.
What's interesting is this is obviously based on a book, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of fans of the book who will mm-hmm. probably really want to see whatever you were cutting, you know, to add to the, you know...
Yeah, I mean, you have when you read a book, you have a dialogue as a reader, and you know, it's the same for us. We have a dialogue with the book. Our dialogue is a little different, and but I think we've arrived at our version of what the movie should be.
Bruce was talking to us a few minutes ago, and he said he really expects that the script was aimed at a women's audience.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the film aimed at, and what about the rest of the guys?
You know, I don't think in those categories. It's never monocausal why you fall in love with something you want to do. I mean, I read a script or I read a project, I read a novel, and I know I'm going to spend 2 to 3 years of my life with that, and exclusively. So you better like it. There better be a honorable, real, real need for you to make that movie. And despite the fact that we were adapting somebody else's work, it's a very, very personal film to me. And when I read the novel, you know, a lot of the things in it resonated with me, and I felt that if we just trusted those things that touched us, then you know that we would be halfway there. And then I had been looking for a love story, very specifically, because I wanted to make a film about a stage in my life. I have a family, I'm married, I'm very, very happy, and I wanted to make a movie for my wife, and a movie that speaks to, you know, what it is to be in a long-term, very, very committed relationship, because at the heart, that's really what it is. It's very grounded that way.
How did the film come to you?
I heard about it, I read the book, and I lobbied for myself. I really wanted to make that movie.
You just announced that you're going to be adapting Warren Ellis' Red, which is a very mm-hmm. different, you know, it's coming from a very different realm, the comic mm-hmm. book. Mm-hmm. I was curious about what interest you do in that, and what you, why you'd like to start tackling some of that.
I'm very eclectic in terms of what I like, what I read, what I watch, just my own consumer, you know, behavior. And I hope I can keep doing that in my professional life, and just try out different things, put new colors on the palette, as it were. I feel like, you know, my first film was a thriller, and Flight Plan was similar to that, and then my second film dealt with very similar themes and issues as this one does, mortality, and dealt with, it was autobiographical. I went through a pretty serious illness early in my life, and I made a movie about that, and so it feels like I revisited those things a little bit, and now I just feel like I want to do something that's not quite so intense, and that's maybe a little more lighter on its feet, and where I can have a little more fun myself.
Do you think a lot of visual cues from the art in the comics? Do you know if you're going to go that far?
No, I don't. You know, it's I don't really like when I met on this film, they asked me, so what's the movie going to look like? And in all honesty, I always answer, I have no idea. You know, it's going to look fine. You know, don't worry. But, it's a real process for me to figure out what the right form for the content is. You know, I don't have one set, and I approach it the same way. I mean, a comic book is one thing, and it works for the comic book, and the movie's going to be different. You know, it has a bit of a different tonality than the comic book. It's very funny and very irreverent. And I'm looking forward to doing that. So, yeah, it looks like it. No.
How much artistic license did you have, if any, going in to stray away from the screenplay?
to stray away from the screenplay. I tend to, the screenplay is a great document because it makes you have many discussions prior to actually being on the floor. I mean, like when the day you stand on the floor, the meter is ticking, and time is of the essence. You can't really afford to not know what you're doing. So I think the screenplay is a great tool to get everybody on the same page, as it were. And so I'm not looking for artistic license with a script. I tend to arrive at a form with a script and feel that that should be, for the time being, what we aim for.
Eric and Rachel were asked earlier about chemistry and how they arrived at it, and they kind of passed the question on to you and said that it's up to the director when he's editing and even when he's working with the two of
them. Yeah, they're not giving themselves enough credit there. I think you either have chemistry or you don't. If you could create chemistry in the editing room, then there would be no films without chemistry, obviously, because there are a lot of good editors out there who can take care of that, then, if that was really how it works. They had a great rapport, and we had an instinct when we cast, and that instinct was borne out by, hopefully, the facts.
Come back to the writing. Bruce mentioned, told us this great story when he came in here, told us how he really wanted to do this. He found the manuscript, started writing it, and then he had someone else got the job. Mm-hmm. And then you came on, brought him on. Did you know that he had been interested in this project?
Yeah, actually, when we met, I was a huge fan of Bruce's, from Jacob's Ladder on, I was a bit of a geek. And I knew all his interviews from The Time and all of that, and that's, one of the great things working in this business is you grow up and you really admire these people and you admire these actors for their work and these writers for their work, and then one day you might actually get to spend time with them and do something with them. So when I sat down with him, I already loved his work, and he said to me, I don't even know if I want to be here. I don't even know if I want to talk to you about this again, because I already lobbied once, and I got, I got kicked out of the room. I'm not sure I want to get kicked out of the room again. And we started to discuss the themes and what was important to us, and it was kind of, we were so very much on the same page on a lot of the big issues that it was a no-brainer. For me, and I was very, very happy that we could work together.
Do you need to work together again? Do you have any other?
I would love to. Yeah, sure. We had a great time together.
I'm assuming you're based over here now.
I'm based in Los Angeles.
Is there any kind of film industry to speak of in Germany?
Film industry is probably a little bigger word for what's. One of the reasons I did two movies over there, and I was getting ready to do a third movie, and one of the reasons I came over was because we, at that time, once again, went right into yet another crisis where it becomes impossible to get a movie made for 2 or 3 years. And the choice you really have is you can go and work for TV, which is so badly paid that you have to really churn them out, which I think probably helps you develop certain muscles, but I'm not sure you really want to have those muscles as a director. And that's when we decided to come over here. I studied at the AFI Film Institute, so I had a lot of friends from that time, and my wife actually is from LA. So it just kind of played out that way. But I didn't get off the boat, all teary, going, "Oh, I'm so lonely." I mean, I have a real social support there.
And what did your wife think about the movie?
She hasn't seen it yet. because I've, in the past, for every single movie I've ever made, I've sort of put her through the ringer. I would show her, dailies. There was my first film, I made her sit through every single shot I'd ever done. And that was, terribly traumatizing to her. And then the second film, I showed her out of sequence. I can't even fathom why I did that, but I did. I showed her the ending first, and then I showed her some. It was bizarre. I don't know. And the third movie she had seen, I would bring home these cuts and these edits. So by the time she went to the premiere, she was like, "Okay, fine." And since this is aimed at, this is for her, I made the decision along with her to spare her the pain. Until she actually has to sit through the premiere, And so, no, she hasn't seen it, but I hope she enjoys it, obviously.
Thank you,
guys. Thank you.
I want to tell you something. It's very rare.